Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Supreme Court overturns the Defense of Marriage Act, and companies rejoice. Remembering Mark Rich and a look at the airport hotel where Edward Snowden may be sleeping. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast from APM. It's Wednesday, the 26th of June, and it's great to have you with us. The Supreme Court overturned the Defense of Marriage Act today, a law that denied federal benefits to same-sex couples. And the court kept in place a lower court ruling that invalidated Prop 8. That's a ballot initiative that banned same-sex marriage in California. Among those paying close attention to the goings-on at the Supreme Court today and to those two decisions were Fortune 500 companies. Many of them signed friend of the court briefs in support of same-sex marriage. So what'd they have at stake? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
Some of the biggest companies in the country have jumped in to support same-sex marriage. Names like Pfizer, Viacom, and Marriott. Marriott signed friend of the court petitions in both same-sex marriage cases. Why? Joanna Todd is in charge of Marriott's marketing strategy toward the gay community. She says Marriott's message is simple.
That you, when you check in with your spouse or your partner, that you're going to be put in a great room and know you're going to have a great experience and that no one will judge you.
Bob Wittick of Wittick Communications advises Marriott and other companies on marketing to gay customers who may be a bit more free spending because they're less likely to have kids. Wittick says for the companies,
they see an opportunity, and they've seen it for years coming, that gay people exist, they shop the same as everybody else, but now they have a chance to actually talk to them.
Wittick points to a recent ad for Amazon's Kindle. A man and woman relax on the beach. You think they're a couple until you hear the tagline.
My husband's bringing me a drink right now.
So is mine.
But companies don't just want to appeal to gay consumers. They also want to attract top talent, regardless of sexual orientation, people who may get several offers. Gary Gates studies gay, bisexual, and transgender legal issues at UCLA.
There's no question that that person will likely look at, you know, whether the company is going to be supportive of them, both through their benefits and through the kind of corporate culture.
Putting companies that do things like provide same-sex benefits way out ahead. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So you search for something online, maybe breakfast cereal or high top fade. You go to Google or Yahoo or DuckDuckGo, Blecko, whatever, and results pop up at the top of the page and at the bottom of the page and maybe in the right-hand corner, too. This may not be news to you, but some of those results are real and relevant, the result of incredibly complex algorithms. The rest of those results are ads. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, wants to make sure that we, the web-surfing public, actually know the difference. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The last time the FTC told search engines to make sure consumers can easily tell the difference between paid search results and natural ones? 11 years ago. That's like a century in internet advertising time.
Over the years, actually, it's become harder to distinguish advertising from natural results.
Mary Engel at the FTC.
It used to be there would be clearer background shading, and that shading got so bland that you really couldn't even see it on different computers, different screens.
This week, Engel's department instructed search sites to more clearly distinguish ad-driven results with cues like borders and labels. Aaron Wall runs a search optimization firm. He showed web users a sample page full of search results.
They looked at it for like 10 seconds, and it had three ads front and center that were pretty big.
But half of them didn't see any ads. They just saw undifferentiated search results. And Wall says advertisers are getting ever wilier. Dynamic keyword insertion lets them personally customize the ad copy using words you just typed into your search. Yankee Group technology analyst Carl Howe.
If there were no advertising along with your search results, you probably wouldn't have a Google to go to today. They make 98% of their revenue from advertising.
Howe says those advertisers are going to keep trying to make paid search results look legit. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a lower-than-expected GDP excites investors. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Mark Rich, the oil trader famously or infamously pardoned by Bill Clinton at the end of his presidency, died today in Switzerland, where he spent a lot of time since his days as a fugitive in the 1980s, trying to outrun charges of tax evasion and illegal trades with Iran, among other things. Craig Capitis is a correspondent for Quartz. He's also the author of a book about Mark Rich. Craig Capitis, it's good to talk to you.
Greetings from Paris.
So this crossed the wires, and to be honest, Mark Rich is someone I haven't thought about in a while. Just remind me, place him in the pantheon of history, if you would.
Rich was the first of the celebrity Wall Street rogues, and by comparison, everyone else was and currently is an amateur. He was a trader who did not deal in the extraordinary popular delusions and madnesses you now see on Wall Street. He actually bought and sold the Earth's crust. Everything in your iPhone, in your computer, in your light bulb, Rich was involved in buying, selling, and delivering. He invented the spot oil market, and he's the only individual in history to have ever successfully manipulated OPEC, the oil companies, and ultimately the price of gasoline in the United States as well as the United States government.
And by doing this, Craig, he became fabulously wealthy.
Galactically wealthy, but perhaps more important to Mark was he was galactically powerful. He was a fabulously powerful and seminal character in the history of global business.
He did business with some shady governments as well. I remember Iran and apartheid South Africa, Cuba, Libya, the list goes on.
Yeah, he was actually charged with tax evasion, trading with the enemy, oil price fixing. And if the federal prosecutors had caught him at the time, they were ready to slap him with charges of treason that would make the kerfuffle over Edward Snowden look like a spat between two gerbils. But perhaps more important, he was also filtering vital information on Russia, Africa, the Arab world, Iran, and other areas to the CIA, and had direct access and a line to the highest levels of the U.S. State Department. There were a number of Justice Department attempts to nab Mark Rich, yet every time they came close, Rich somehow found out and managed to get away.
So January 20th, 2001, a big day here in the life of Mark Rich. Bill Clinton is getting ready to leave the White House, and he pardons the man. After that pardon was granted, did Mark Rich come back to the U.S.? He lived most of his life in Europe. Did he make a trip back to the U.S.?
No, he never did. He never went back to the United States. He spent his final years working with Glencore, which was the company that he started in the United States when
the big commodities giant
when he first got in trouble with the feds. He tried to create another company to hide his assets and his trades, and that didn't work. And he sold Glencore, you know, many years later. But the DNA of Glencore is still very Mark Rich.
Quartz's Craig Capitis wrote Metal Men, How Mark Rich Defrauded the Country, Evaded the Law, and Became the World's Most Sought-After Corporate Criminal. Great to talk to you, Craig.
Thank you.
By all accounts, Edward Snowden is still in Moscow at an airport there. The U.S. wants to arrest him for violating the Espionage Act. It could be months before Snowden is able to leave Russia. He's asked the country of Ecuador for asylum. If you're carrying several laptops packed with government secrets, you can't exactly stretch out on a bench to get some shut-eye. Well, luckily for Snowden, the airport has what's called a capsule hotel, a pod hotel, a place where travelers can rent very tiny rooms for a few hours at a time if you've missed your connection, or for longer if you're fleeing the feds. Capsule hotels are popping up in airports and cities around the world. Marketplace's Mark Garrison checked one out in New York to see how Snowden may be snoozing. The lobby of Pod 39 in Midtown gives no hint it's a capsule hotel. It looks like a cool new boutique. The restaurant is packed with hipster bait, fancy tacos, complex cocktails, attractive young staff. But take the elevator up, and it's clearly a capsule.
This is one of our more popular room categories. It's our bunk pod.
Hotel GM Scott Yeo says it's available for $195 tonight. That's far cheaper than a typical Manhattan hotel and smaller, but it's palatial compared to the tiniest pod rooms. They're 65 square feet and currently sold out. Snowden would appreciate the sturdy safe, which fits several data-rich laptops. A shower will refresh after a sleepless night in a cold sweat, and plenty of pillows to line the door to foil snoops, as Snowden did in Hong Kong. The hotel's GM is on the case.
We ration 2 pillows per person, but we always have more in case you need more pillows.
Excellent. There's also free Wi-Fi, so Snowden can leak to his heart's content. Back in the lobby, guest Jim Vondracek shudders at the notion of being holed up in a capsule for long.
There's definitely a cell-like aspect to it just because the walls are very close to you.
He hit his head a couple times, but overall, he enjoyed his 3-night stay. The hotel's developers didn't originally expect to attract many business travelers like him. That surprise popularity is part of why more capsule hotels are opening up to squeeze guests in. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Want to take a peek inside a pod hotel? We've got video of a cramped room from that airport hotel in Moscow Ed Snowden may have visited, and some photos of the one that Mark looked at marketplace.org. Well, if Edward Snowden weren't on the lam, he might have been interested in a trade fair called the Big Data Congress that opened today in London. The exhibitors are in the business of cloud computing. They collect, store, and exploit huge quantities of data governments and companies accumulate. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went along to eavesdrop.
You might have thought that in the wake of Edward Snowden's revelations, anyone involved in big data would be a little worried. You'd think the allegations of wholesale online spying by US and British authorities might undermine confidence in the cloud. Not a bit of it, claims Olivier Meiss of digital technology group Citrix.
I don't think it's going to change the momentum that you see in the way that people want to consume IT. It's just too powerful in terms of flexibility, rapid growth of company innovation that you can fuel for new businesses that are using the cloud as their new IT department.
I didn't find a single downbeat exhibitor here at the show, nor one who professed surprise at Snowden's revelations. Many said, of course we all knew something like that was going on. Jason Bloomberg of the tech firm ZapThink said the bigger surprise and cause for alarm was Snowden's actions.
How easy it is for a single renegade to cause so much trouble. And this is a key part of the story, right? The more important your information is, the greater the chance that just one lone wolf is going to, you know, open the floodgates.
Bloomberg and other exhibitors said the most important consideration was whether or not the U.S. abused the data it monitored and collected. Alex Hilton speaks for Britain's cloud industry. He feels most British companies still trust their data to American servers.
99% of organizations, I don't think they're too worried about where their data is stored. That's not an issue. And if they have nothing to hide in the first place, which clearly most people don't, I don't think there's an issue here.
So long as commercial secrets are not exposed, he said, online monitoring by the US government is not a problem. But the British inventor of the World Wide Web has a very different take. In a newspaper interview today, Tim Berners-Lee accused Western governments of hypocrisy for spying on the internet while lecturing repressive regimes for doing the same. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When you actually see them investing hundreds of thousands of dollars in restoring something that has been here for a long, long time, they're investing in the people here.
Restoring historic theaters. It's about more than just the movies. But first, let's do the numbers. America's economic growth is smaller than we thought, so of course that means the markets jumped higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added another 149 points, 1%, to end at 14,910. The NASDAQ charged up 28 points, 0.8%, to finish at 3376. The S&P 500 rose 15 points, 1%, to close at 1603. That slower, some say anemic, growth rate of 1.8% means investors didn't have to worry about the end of the Fed's stimulus program. It was a mixed bag for earnings reports. Bed Bath & Beyond floated up 1.7%. Monsanto and General Mills shed 0.5%. And the payroll company Paychex added 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. A look at how much we earned and how much left our wallets in May. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. And for 10 years, people have been signing up in hopes of keeping unwanted callers from interrupting dinner. On June 27, 2003, the Do Not Call Registry launched. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. President Obama heads to Africa today. It's his second visit to the continent since he took office, and his agenda is packed. The purpose of the week-long trip is to promote U.S. business interests and democracy, and to address issues like food security. President Obama will visit South Africa and Tanzania, but his first stop is Senegal. Thomas Fessy is the BBC's West Africa correspondent, and he joins us from Senegal. Thomas, thanks for your time.
Yep.
Thomas, what's the reaction been among the Senegalese to the visit here by the president and his family to Senegal? How are they perceiving this visit?
Well, as a matter of fact, we're just seeing the American and Senegalese flags being put up, you know, posters of President Obama and Macky Sall together on the same picture. Welcome to Senegal, it says. I think that most people are proud that President Obama is coming here to Senegal.
Characterize for me, if you would, that relationship between Senegal and the U.S.
Well, there's the relationship between the two countries is mostly about the fact that the U.S. has been promoting democracy. I think the business relationship, for example, trade, is very tiny. The main sector that is invested in by the Americans so far in Senegal remains agriculture. Obviously, the main problem remains that doing business here is not that easy. You know, Senegal remains one of the 20 worst countries, according to the World Bank, to do business here, but since the new president has been elected, there are a lot of efforts to make sure that it is attractive for investment and obviously American investors.
Just as you walk around the streets and talk to people there, what do people say about President Obama, about the U.S.?
Well, interestingly enough, if you look at the people who are in their 50s or plus, would be having much more references towards France and Europe. And I think that a lot of young people are now more fascinated by the U.S. and the American dream than what's going on in Europe. So I think there is that feeling that things can be done in the U.S. And I think that the Senegalese people, especially the youngest generation, certainly hope that American investors can now help them find this way in the country.
Thomas Fessy, the BBC's West Africa correspondent, on the line from Senegal, where President Obama is kicking off a week-long trip through Africa. Thomas, thanks.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
U.S., commercial fishing generates billions of dollars a year. It's been big business in Massachusetts for a long time, thanks to one fish in particular, cod, as in Cape Cod. But after decades of overfishing that species, a lot of fishermen in the Bay State are struggling. Some of them want to build a new market for a fish that's so abundant, they have to try not to catch it. Shannon Mullen has more.
There's a 5-foot-long wooden sacred cod that's been hanging in the Massachusetts State House since the early 1700s. Back then, the saying went that cod were so abundant, you could almost walk across the ocean on their backs. Today, they're so scarce, the legal limit fishermen can catch was just cut by almost 80% to let the species recover. Nick Muto is head of the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance.
When I started fishing 11 years ago, there'd be 6 boats here lined up right now to unload their limit of codfish. We caught 2. And we went 100 miles to go get them.
As Muto helps offload a day's catch at the town fish pier in Chatham, he holds up a 3-foot shark that he says could eventually help fill the void of cod. The spiny dogfish is so prolific that fisheries managers just raised catch limits to cull the population.
We use hook and line for them, and they're every hook for 600 straight hooks. They're that abundant.
What about when you're not fishing for dogfish?
They're still there in abundance.
But Muto says it's hard to make a living catching just dogfish. Fishermen get about 15 cents per pound for them at the dock, compared to $3 for a pound of cod. The issue is consumer awareness, or lack thereof.
People aren't used to it. Big problem is the word dogfish.
Andy Baylor is a wholesale fish dealer in Chatham, and he runs a tiny fish market and fry kitchen on the town pier. He says besides the awkward name, dogfish doesn't really look like fish until you cook it. The top markets are France and England, where it's battered and fried for fish and chips.
You got an English guy in here, it's like, oh yeah, great. Americans, forget it. But it's all about marketing. Make a nice product out of it, and once some people get a taste of something, they learn to enjoy it.
But Baylor says most fishermen don't have extra money for marketing, so his and other local businesses are stepping up to help. Alex Hay is a fish dealer and co-owner of Max Seafood Restaurants on the Outer Cape. This summer, he's putting dogfish on the menu at all 3 of his locations.
The restaurant always sort of breaks the ice, so to speak, and get people used to it there, and then maybe when they go into the retail counter, they'll say, hey, well, I had that in the restaurant. It was quite good, so maybe I can try that at home.
Hay says it takes time to grow the market for new types of fish. Remember tilapia? Fishermen are also trying to introduce dogfish to large-scale buyers, like prison systems and universities, to increase demand. But they don't see the dogfish replacing the sacred cod up at the State House, at least not anytime soon. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
The multiplex hasn't been great for historic theaters. Hundreds of them in small towns have fallen into disrepair. Some are sitting empty. But one of the country's largest old-time theaters hopes to reverse that trend. Gene Bonner with Georgia Public Broadcasting has the story.
What's the nicest building in your town? In Atlanta, many people would say it's the historic Fox Theater. From the street, you can see the original gold-encrusted ticket booth and the majestic marquee. Inside, the ceiling is painted to look like the starry night sky. Adina Irwin is the Fox's general manager. She says people love the historic theater in their town because it's beautiful, and it's a tie to the past.
The historic theater in these downtowns is one of the few remaining true authentic sources of the community.
The Fox is thriving, but in the 1970s, Atlanta was about to bulldoze the old place before residents rallied to save it. The Fox Theater is doing so well that its staff now helps other old Georgia theaters stay alive, and they award grants, typically $20,000 to $25,000. Irwin says often a town council owns the theater or the local chamber of commerce.
Many of the people that are operating these theaters, the managers, they don't come from the theater world. They don't come from working in any theater, whether it's historic or non-historic.
The question is, can the Fox replicate its success in other places? About 2 hours east of Atlanta, the folks in Warrenton, Georgia, really hope so.
This is the projector room.
The nicest building in Warrenton, hands down, is the Knox Theater, but it's been closed since the 1990s. Obi McCorkle is head of the town's Chamber of Commerce, and she's helping bring the Knox back to life. Why? Well, for starters, she had her first date there.
I don't remember what I saw.
I remember what I wore, and I remember who I was with.
But can you really support a theater in a town with only 1,900 residents? Warrenton officials still need about $500,000 to complete the renovation, even with last year's grant from the Fox Theater. On the other side of the state, an historic theater in Rome, Georgia, found a way to make it work. That's where you'll find the DeSoto Theater, the first theater the Fox ever helped. Like many small theaters, it splits its time between showing movies and staging plays. But the DeSoto Theater has a third identity. On Sunday morning, it's home to Seven Hills Fellowship Church.
Let's take a moment and pray before we move to the announcements. Father, we thank you that you've invited us into this place.
The church isn't just a tenant, it's a partner in the renovation. Over the last 7 years, it's invested $400,000 for items like a restored foyer and a new movie screen. Steve Lanier grew up in Rome and then moved away, but he stopped by recently to check out the theater.
When you actually see them investing hundreds of thousands of dollars in restoring something that is intergenerational, it's been here for a long, long time. So they're investing in the culture and the ebb and flow of the people here.
So far, the Fox has helped more than 25 theaters directly. It's unclear if Warrenton will see the same success as Rome. McCorkle is optimistic. She remembers when they relit the marquee.
People came out, and it was just so exciting. They loved it. They just loved to see the lights come back on.
At night, she says, the marquee lights up the whole town. In Atlanta, I'm Jean Bonner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, we've heard about stand-up desks and treadmill desks. Well, there's new research from a Columbia Business School professor that shows a link between where you sit and how you act at the office. Seems the bigger the desk, the more dishonest you're likely to be. Environments that expand the body can inadvertently lead us to feel more powerful, the researchers write. And these feelings of power can cause dishonest behavior. You heard that here first from a guy who just pocketed a few of Kai Rizdahl's pens from what's really a pretty nice-sized desk. Good view, a lot of natural light. I don't think he's going to miss them. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 149 points. That's 1%. The Nasdaq charged up 28 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 rose 15 points, 1%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.